good evening, everyone, or good morning, or good afternoon, depending upon where you are on this rotating globe. Welcome to another edition live of The Other Side of Midnight. Tonight we're talking eclipses, when things in the solar system go in front of other things, and very peculiar things happen. Now, you're not going to learn that in a mainstream astronomy class because it's not being taught yet, but it will be because we have so many things to talk about in terms of the moon tonight and the impending solar eclipse of April 8th, 2024, which is literally slightly over a week from tonight. Tonight's the 30th. We're counting down the hours now till April. And then April 8th, this is the first total eclipse of the sun that's been visible in the United States for 7 years, since the one many years ago that crossed the United States. The last eclipse I was able to share with Robin. We're going to get into a little bit about Robin tonight because something very peculiar has been going on, and I need to know whether it's just in my life or in other people's lives. So we will introduce that at the appropriate time later in the show. My prime guest tonight is our hyperdimensional astrologer, Rick Levine. I call him a hyperdimensional astrologer because, of course, that's the physics, the science under which astrology has been operating forever. It's just that it's kind of been forgotten. I remember a very famous Sagan quote decades ago where he proudly extolled the idea that the gravitational field from the doctor who was delivering the baby in the delivery room is much larger than any possible influence from Jupiter or Mars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the only problem with that is that, you know, astrology does not work by a gravity. It works via something much more interesting and elegant and subtle, and we will get into all of that tonight. But before we go celestial, I want to go to the news tonight, Radio with Pictures. You know how to get there. You go to the website, theothersideofmidnight.com. That's our website, our URL. Click on that, and you'll take you to tonight's homepage, where we have a very bright banner for tonight's looming hyperdimensional effects of the coming solar eclipse. And that is, of course, for tonight, March 30th, Saturday. Every time you guys send me something goes up on the website, you know, you should put the date and the time of the show. It makes finding them much, much easier, just for future reference, everyone who's listening out there, because some folks do send me things that are relevant to a show, and if you would put the tag in the subject line as to which show you're referencing, it would be very helpful. So before we get into the details of this amazing eclipse that's coming, I want you to go to the guest page, which is you click on the banner for tonight on the homepage. That will take you to the guest page to March 30th, and under that, when you get there, under that banner, you will see where it says fast links to items. Click on my name. That will take you to our section of the guest page called Radio with Pictures. And item number one, I don't know whether any of you have been following this really extraordinary story, because I actually watched, like within an hour of it falling, the bridge, the Francis Scott Key Bridge, hit by that ship, the Dolly, 95,000 ton, cargo carrier, which apparently lost power. You can see it in the really good video where all the lights, you know, go out on the ship, then they come back on because they lost power, propulsion, and steering, and they were not able to get back into the center of a fairly narrow channel going up into the harbor of Baltimore, Chesapeake Bay from the Atlantic. And the ship at 8 knots, give or take, inevitably did what ships do when they're not under steering and propulsion. It drifted, and they had particularly timed, it turns out, this ship leaving Boston Harbor for when there was a strong outflowing tide, because this, of course, saves fuel and money. And so when the ship lost propulsion, there was a tidal current moving down the Chesapeake out toward the ocean, you know, pulled, of course, by what? By the moon. We're going to talk about it a lot tonight. And inevitably, it wound up hitting something, and it turned out to be one of the two major supporting piers of this arching span, and the whole thing came down on video. It's just astonishing. There have been several analyses that have been posted by engineers, and the reason I'm kind of bringing this to our attention is because it actually will affect the entire United States. About half of the cars and coal that enters and leaves the U.S. enters and leaves by way of the Baltimore port. So you cannot have such a huge supply chain problem for very long before it's going to show up in supermarkets around the world. It's going to show up here. It's going to increase inflation. It's not a good thing. What I found interesting, given that it was so riveting to watch the collapse, is how little has been done, apparently, in terms of infrastructure to protect these fragile bridges across many waterways where there is very high volumes of container traffic and other ships. The piers surrounding these vital, you know, aerial ways and highways and bridges and railroads across, you know, waterways are incredibly poorly protected. I mean, all you have to do is look at some of these very carefully done YouTube videos by, again, engineers to notice that the simplest, you know, defense against this would have been several large concrete pillars called dolphins. I'm not quite sure why they're calling them dolphins. But in some areas around the country, you can see in the aerial imagery that the piers are protected by the simple expedient of driving into the bedrock, deep pilings, pouring a lot of concrete that gives you a, you know, like a 10-foot drum that extends vertically like a pillar down below the water, below the bedrock anchored in whatever is down there. And if a ship were to hit one of those or two of those concrete pilings that are arrayed as arresters, as bumpers, around pilings of the bridge, the ship would wind up colliding with the piling. They might even snap off, who knows, depending upon the force. But it would save the pier. It would save the support of the bridge. That was not done with the Francis Scott Key Bridge, although it is true in other bridges, and one, of course, should be, as the federal government, accessing details on all bridges to see if they could withstand something like a 95,000-ton ship moving at about 6 miles an hour, if they could withstand that. Because if they couldn't, then this appears to me to be a very obvious place that some of that infrastructure money that the Congress passed, you know, a year or two ago should be allocated toward this, because look at what this is doing. It's not only severing a vital commuter bridge from southern to northern Maryland, it's part of the beltway system that takes traffic around Baltimore that detours it over toward, you know, the ocean, that doesn't get caught in downtown or, you know, commuter traffic, et cetera, et cetera. I would think an inventory of all of the major bridges in the United States, if not the world, would be necessary right now, because the cost of putting in the pilings is trivial, you know, retrofitting, compared to the cost of replacing this bridge. One estimate I saw was $2 billion just to replace the bridge. That's not counting all the lawsuits from all the people who have been, you know, basically affected which includes something like 8,000 to 10,000 workers at the port of Baltimore, to say nothing of all the support infrastructure, all the companies, restaurants, banks, et cetera. In other words, when you have something of this magnitude happen, there is a ripple effect which cascades across the culture and the economy and the civilization. And to think that for something as simple as a few concrete pilings strategically placed around these piers, there'd be no problem. So then the question, of course, arises, well, why didn't someone think to do this? And the answer is because what is inconceivable for you to imagine, most people, is what they cannot see. And no one apparently thought in all these years, since I think this bridge was put up in 77, it's a relatively modern bridge, why they didn't, given the fact that it's in one of the busiest ports on the planet, put in protective barriers around the pilings, around the bridge supports, is just, it's kind of like, what? What were you not thinking? Anyway, hindsight is 2020. Tonight, we're now going to shift our focus and talk about this very impressive total solar eclipse that's going to happen on Monday, shortly after noon, our time here, shortly after 1 Central Time. If you look at my item number 2, this is a NASA map. It shows the percentage along the left and right edges and the top of the bottom of those isocontour lines that are paralleling the total eclipse track. If you're favorable, excuse me, if you're in that favorable position of being in that black, you know, corridor going from Texas all the way up to north of Maine, that's where the eclipse will be total. And unlike the one in 2012 or 2017, I'm thinking of the one in 2017, this will be a much longer eclipse. It'll be twice as long for most of the people in that shadow path, 4 minutes, as opposed to only a couple minutes. If reasonable, you really want to be toward the edges of that totality, not at the edge, but toward the edge. That's what Tom Van Flandern told me years ago, and that's where he took the people that he would take on eclipse expeditions around the world, because there you get the best of both worlds. You get the effects of the inner corona and the solar surface disappearing behind the sun, but you get extended time to see prominences that are above the sun. And with a 4-minute eclipse, the sun will be considerably smaller, like, you know, 100 miles or so, than the shadow outline. So if you position yourself more toward the edge than toward the center line, totality, you get long time of the prominences, and you get the best opportunity to see the incredible glass dome completely surrounding the eclipsed sun, because you're looking at the backside, at the dark side, the night side of the Earth at this moment, which, of course, you cannot see. And we'll get into how you can see it a little later in the program. Anyway, for those of you lucky enough to be in that path, the last time you had an eclipse was about, if you were in Carbondale, Illinois, it's been twice in 7 years. The average, if you're on the planet, excuse me, is about once every 300, 350 years, if you don't move, that an eclipse will come to you. In this case, in Carbondale, Illinois, the residents there are going to see 2 eclipses in like 7 tetrahedral years, which is definitely beating the percentages, and it's worth it. Item number 3. A lot of people, given the fact of technology, are going to look at the phone in their hands and look at the sky and say, well, I wonder if I could take a decent picture with my smartphone, with my cell phone. And the answer is yes, but you have to do some homework. So that's what number 3 is all about. Go into number 3, look at all the links. You know, you got a week to steep yourself in how to do this. The key thing is what we call plate scale. What is plate scale? I'm not talking dinner service now. I'm talking the size of the moon's image on your screen, because the moon is only half a degree optically in diameter. So it's really, really very tiny in the sky. It only looks bigger because your brain is doing something interesting and, you know, makes it bigger, you know, psychologically. But in fact, it's, the moon is pretty small in the sky. So if you're going to see, and definitely if you're going to record anything with your cell phone, you need to read item number 3, and then you need to read item number 4. There is a telescope for about $200 that you can buy, that you can marry your smartphone to, a smart telescope for $200 that will allow you to fill the screen of your smartphone with the image of the moon. And then, of course, whether you get the corona or you get the glass over the edge of the moon or you get what's shining toward you that you can't see because it's much, 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 much dimmer than even the corona, is, of course, the reflected light from the Earth on the moon that gives you a ghostly image of the moon, which, of course, you can see in item number 5. Now, how come it's so obvious there? And in number 4, you see a kind of a classical image presented by this company, Theonis Hestia, that turns your phone into a smart telescope by giving you an ancillary optical aid. It's because that image taken in number 5 is a very special image taken by a Czechoslovakian astronomer. And what we've done is to boost contrast and brightness. So what you see on the dark side, because that's the side facing toward the Earth during an eclipse, just think of the geometry, you can see some really interesting details. And I won't waste time now on what they are, because we'll do that when we talk to all our guests. So without further ado, let me go check something here and look and see if I've got everything lined up properly. Let me do this. Yes, yes, we do. Keith, thank you so much. So without further ado, let me introduce Rick Levine, who, as I said, is our hyperdimensional astrologer. He's got a whole bunch of other titles that I probably should go through just a bit. He's been a professional astrologer since 1976. He's become a respected leader in the global astrology community, past president of the Washington State Astrology Association, co-founder of StarIQ.com, a founding trustee of Kepler College, a co-author of 8 years of Barnes & Noble's annual Your Astrology Guide. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff there you can read if you want to. But I'm basically familiar with Rick as the only hyperdimensional astrologer that I know. So without further ado, Rick, come on down.
Well, greetings to you. And my other title that you forgot to mention is Lord of Light.
Okay, well, dark.
Or dark. Or both.
Or both. Okay, why is this eclipse even now feeling different than the one that we were treated to 7 years ago? What's special about this one, besides the fact that if you live in Carbondale, you get this incredible, rare opportunity to walk out your front door and see another one?
Well, I am going to suggest that the reason why this eclipse is different, is already feeling different, is less about the eclipse than it is about all the other circumstantial things building up, many of which are, in fact, hyperdimensionally astrological. But what you're saying is true. This is a very profound and powerful period of time, and the eclipse in this time is a catalyst for the reactions that we are about to move through.
That's kind of the way I was thinking about it. Everybody's kind of looking at this in the context of what's going on in the world and in the country. And because eclipses always have this kind of shade of weirdness about them, you know, Chinese notwithstanding, who used to bang every pot they could find to keep the dragon from, you know, retaining the sun after he swallowed the sun, that kind of thing. There just seems to be an amplifier effect that somehow, and I can't do the science yet about this, but I just have the feeling that this eclipse tracking across the country, you know, next week, next Monday, I think it's next Monday, is really going to do something with people's heads.
Yes, and, you know, when we astrologers look at eclipses, we look at a number of things, but one of the things we look at is what is the point at which the sun and the moon are joining, the eclipse point. Is that point lining up with anything else? And then secondarily,
Are you talking about on the moon or on the Earth?
I'm talking about from the Earth's perspective.
Okay, okay.
When you look at the moon and then at the sun, if you continue on that trajectory, is there anything else on that same path? That's one thing. We'll come back to that in a second. The second thing is, are there any other obvious and visible planets that are in a straight line, again, geocentrically from our point of view? And the answer to both of those questions on this eclipse is yes. And the most important thing is that we are moving in April toward a once every 14-year conjunction of Jupiter, the largest, as we know, planet in the solar system, that lines up or catches up every 14 years to Uranus, the first planet that is outside of the orbit of the visible planets, that in some ways is the planet of shock, of awakening, of breaking through, its sudden shifts in awareness. And every 14 years, and this is not within the realm of our discussion right now, but one can look back and see the incredible technological breakthroughs that happen, you know, usually 3-4 months on either side of that Jupiter-Uranus conjunction. And so we're already feeling that. They are, at the time of the eclipse, already 2 degrees, only 2 degrees apart from actually perfecting at a 0-degree, you know, angle, which they will do on April 20th. So that's one thing. Secondly, from Earth's point of view, we also have a conjunction and an alignment that is of Mars and Saturn. And that is also within a degree, less than a degree and a half. And because Mars moves faster than Jupiter, that this conjunction will perfect within just a day or two after the eclipse. And Mars and Saturn astrologically are incredibly potent energies, because Mars is physical energy. Mars is, I know this is your favorite planet for many, many reasons. But Mars, as the ancient god of war, is really the god is really the planet related to force, to direction, towards things that happen in the material realm that have inertia. And Mars is meeting up with Saturn, which astrologically is the planet of limitation or structure. We astrologers think of Mars-Saturn conjunctions as the gas pedal, Mars, or the accelerator, Mars, and the brake, Saturn, happening simultaneously, which has its own storyline. So the third thing is that this eclipse is within 0 minutes. That's like, it's like exact for all practical purposes, lined up with the Centaur, the planetoid Chiron, which was discovered in 1977 and first thought to be a new planet and then thought to be an asteroid and then thought to be a comet. And finally, it was realized that it was the first of a whole class of planetoids called Centaurs that are kind of pretty much between the orbits of Saturn and Uranus. And Chiron, the mythology of Chiron is Chiron was a centaur, but he was also a teacher. He was the original mentor. He taught Asclepius and Hercules, and he was a teacher of the Olympian gods. And Chiron is also the wounded healer. And so in a way, this eclipse lining up with Chiron is also exposing our wounds as a culture, as you know, of humanity, and giving us an opportunity to do something about it. So these three separate things, the conjunction of the sun and moon and Chiron at 19 degrees and 24 minutes of Aries, that's the eclipse, then the conjunction of Jupiter and Uranus, but that we'll talk more about maybe in weeks to follow, and it'll take months for that to unfold, but we're already seeing that in ripplings and rumblings in areas of AI or ASI, artificial superintelligence, and ET, and the things that you're going to be talking about later tonight on the moon, and also in other technological breakthroughs, that's there. And then the Saturn Mars, which is incidentally the bridge collision that you talked about earlier. If you think of the ship as Mars, it having velocity, momentum, inertia, and the bridge being the Saturn, being the structure that it hit. And one other thing before I take a pause or I take a breath, Richard, there is you mentioned that the bridge itself was actually opened in 1977. And as a research astrologer, I know that the bridge actually opened on the morning of March 23rd, 1977. And it's intriguing that the synodic cycle of Mars to the Sun, that's from Earth's point of view, every 47 years. And lo and behold, the destruction of this bridge was on the first return of this synodic cycle, because it's 47 years since that bridge was opened in March of 1977. So just an intriguing side fact here.
Very interesting. So if you were to encapsulate, like in a line or two, what people should be aware of in terms of this eclipse, what would that be?
Okay, so in order, I can do it.
And we only got about 2 minutes, and then we'll pick it up on the other side.
Perfect. In the slides that we have in the pictures, there is a quote from Pythagoras, who is really the first person who realized that there are no things in the universe. There's no solid things, that everything is vibration. And then the following slide by Nikola Tesla, a quote: if you want to find the secrets of the universe, think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. But it's the third slide that I want to end this on, because you mentioned Carbondale as the point of the crossing of the two eclipses, the 2017 eclipse and this eclipse coming up, being in Carbondale, which is where Richard Buckminster Fuller did his work at the University of Southern Illinois. And Fuller wrote, "The comprehensive fact, however, is that nothing in the universe touches anything else. There are no solids. There are, in fact, no things, no things. Universe," he wrote, "consists of frequency and angle." So when this entire physical universe is basically an artifact, an illusion, a persistent one, as Albert Einstein said, and it's created by high-frequency electromagnetic radiation crossing paths.
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Oh. My first guest this morning is Rick Levine, our hyperdimensional astrologer. We're talking about the coming total solar eclipse, which marks time as nothing else you can imagine marks time, which is kind of appropriate, given the dark side of the moon and Pink Floyd. Here on the other side of midnight, my name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
Thank you. theothersideofmidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcaster to provide you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to The Other Side of Midnight for this Saturday, March 30th of 2024. Pink Floyd in the background, Dark Side of the Moon. So appropriate, because during an eclipse, the dark side of the moon is facing Earth. Okay, Rick, go ahead.
So, I love the Pink Floyd accompaniment. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I'm having flashbacks. No kidding. So the thing is that how do I want to say this? When frequencies intersect with each other, they crisscross at a point that physicists call nodes. Anyone who does any sort of radio engineering knows that, for example, antennas are tuned to harmonics of frequencies. That's how we pick up certain signals. And the word node actually derived from a Latin word nodus, which means a knot or a lump. And in fact, the word knot also comes from the Latin word node. And a node is actually where waves crossing each other manifest as particles. You know, the whole particle-wave duality that we're not going to talk about now, but at the subatomic level, we know that light travels like a wave, and yet when you measure it, it pops into a particle that we call a photon, but when we're not looking at it, it travels like a wave. How does it do that? Well, when you go outside and look at the moon, it's a particle. I call them the planets in the moon, I call them BFPs, for big fucking particles. but they're particles. And yet when you're not looking at the moon and any other planet, it travels, it propagates like a wave. So here's the deal. The wave of the moon going around the Earth intersects with the wave of the Earth going around the sun. Where those two waves intersect, those are the nodes of the moon. Those are the nodes where the moon's wave crisscrosses with the Earth's wave. This happens twice a month because the moon goes around the Earth once a month, once a moon. But if there's a new moon or a full moon, while the moon is crossing or near the node, that's when we see an eclipse. And the ancients knew about this. They knew about the Saros cycle, the cycle of the repetition of, you know, of the moon's nodes that take about 19 years to move backwards once. And so eclipses, every new moon and full moon astrologically is an important point, because a new moon is like the beginning of the cycle and a full moon is like something coming into fruition. When there is a new moon that aligns with the nodal point, which is what happens on April 8th, the sun and the moon, and in this case, Chiron also, are exactly aligned, or within a couple of degrees, aligned with the node that creates almost like a hyperdimensional vortex portal that actually collapses time and brings things from the past and from the future into the moment of present manifestation. And that's why eclipses can be so powerful.
And this one in particular. I mean, look what's on, and, look what's on the table. Look at all the stuff we're dealing with.
This one in particular.
Oh my God, yes.
But again, part of the thing is that we are at a point that has been being set up in some ways since the every other century alignment of Uranus and Pluto in the mid-60s, which created the 60s. Since their square in the early 2010, 2012 to 2015, when we went through another major eye of the needle, and then certainly in 2020 when Saturn lined up with Pluto and we had the whole quarantine meltdown and everything else that went along with that month of March of 2020 that never ended. And in some ways, all of that now, as we're moving into new territory, I say that astrologically, as a looking at the map of time, we're now moving into new territory. And this eclipse and the things that are happening along with Pluto's move into a new sign, into the sign of Aquarius, and along with the other outer planets all changing signs over the next year or so, the world in which we live from 2022, 2023, compared to the world that we will be living in 25, 26, will be different in so many ways that we cannot imagine, even if we feel imaginative.
Well, wait a minute. Are you talking about a major, major paradigm shift?
I'm talking about a major paradigm shift that that could involve. I think that this is AIET and maybe Old McDonald's Farm EIEIO. but I think that it's a huge paradigm shift, and I think that the two important things are ET and AI, because they're going to change who we think we are, and we're going to change the relationship that we have from the inner to the outer universe or to the cosmos. Yeah, I think it's that big.
Well, I do too, but I don't know whether my big is your big. Tell you what, let's bring on an arbitrator. I have the perfect person, Georgia Lambert, who is a...
I knew you were going to say Georgia's not an arbitrator, because she's going to just agree with what I'm saying and then double down and make it even more sensible.
Oh, is that why she said all caps, yes, exclamation point, exclamation
Hi, Georgia.
Georgia, well, for the audience, that you know, we have people who come new, so we have to do a kind of an intro. If you want to read any of the detailed background bios, just go to the Other Side of Midnight on the where it says bios. Fast link to bios under the banner, and that will take you to their extensive backgrounds. The key thing you need to know about Georgia is, A, she knows one hell of a lot about occult mysticism and secret sacred sciences. She was with Manly P. Hall for about 10 years. She's the resident hyperdimensional metaphysician for The Other Side of Midnight, and she's one hell of a good friend. Georgia, welcome.
Hi, good to be with everybody. Yeah, Rick, I'm going to back you up here from a little bit different perspective. From a metaphysical perspective, the moon, in ways that are too long to go into tonight, represents our past. And the sun is the heart chakra of our solar system. So in an eclipse, the moon is eclipsing the connection with the heart temporarily to bring up the past in our face directly. And we've talked on other shows about the 60s, that something happened where there was a weird glitch in time and we kind of got off track. And the astrology that Rick has just laid out so beautifully may be the cudgel that's needed to get us back on track, because right now it's like we're coming back to the point where we should have glitched not happened, And we are experiencing two colliding realities, and they need to be integrated back into a one physical reality. And the astrology that Rick's talking about may do just that.
So when you guys are talking about this major event, you're not talking about, you know, we go to bed one night, we wake up the next morning, and there's this huge new world. It's going to evolve in front of our eyes, right? At an accelerated rate, right?
Well, I don't think going to. I think it is. I think it's current time. That is that we are in the midst of this. You know, every point from a distance looks like a point, but as you get closer and closer to it, it dissolves into a whole lot of other points, and we're in that process now.
Well, I was kind of thinking that the eclipse will accelerate or amplify or magnify these trends which we're seeing all around us.
Yes.
By
well,
how much?
Again, the idea of our past coming up into our consciousness to be dealt with right before the next full moon on the 23rd, which is in the Eastern tradition, Wesak, which is the most potent moon of the whole year. That's when the spiritual download happens. It's going to unfold in the fall. And we've got a lot of stuff that we need to pay attention to in the fall. So
you think? gosh.
Yeah.
By the way, that next full moon after this eclipse, that's 2 days before my birthday.
And it's right on my birthday.
That's true. Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah.
You'll be impossible. You'll be impossible to live with.
And this solar eclipse is on my birthday because I'm in April 6th and the eclipse is the 8th. So I'll take the solar eclipse.
Oh, my gosh.
There you go.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, this next full moon on the 23rd is going to be really important in terms of getting humanity's aspiration as high as possible so that we can receive what we need to deal with what's coming in the fall.
Well, and also that eclipse will be very, very close, just 3 days away from the exact Jupiter-Uranus conjunction, which I can't say enough about its importance in, because Jupiter's expansion, it opens us up. It's like a magnifying lens, and Uranus is like Father Sky. It's like it's like the farthest reaches, but there's no time involved when things happen with that are connected with the planet Uranus. It's like lightning striking. It's like an instantaneous thing. It's very technological. It's very electrical.
And this of course is propelling us toward 2025 and 2026 when big openings are possible for humanity's consciousness.
Yes.
Well, the thing that intrigues me about all this is we've had, you know, a lot of eclipses, solar and lunar, and a lot of alignments and a lot of astrological significators, but the thing for me that makes this eclipse so different is that everybody looking up at the moon, crossing over and blotting out the sun, needs to know that there's this incredible residuum of extraordinary high technology by somebody. Think of the past, Georgia, left by somebody in our human past all over the moon, which you can see during this eclipse if you've got the right equipment and a little bit of foreknowledge. And I'm hoping as we go through the morning that we'll be able to lay out how people can actually do this to where some people are going to actually have an amazing surprise. I want everyone to look, particularly Rick, I want you to look at image number 5, my item number 5. We got it?
Yes.
Okay. This is an enlargement of the image that I used for tonight's banner. It is a close-up of the total eclipse of the Earth, of the sun by the moon, but it's basically a very unusual view because you never, ever, ever see the moon circled by the corona of the sun up until relatively recently when software was able to develop programs so that digital imagers can actually take multiple images and produce composites where you got the incredible detail of the corona in the background and you got the incredible detail of the sun on the side of the earth that looks like a black circle if you look at number four. But yeah, that's really what if your eyes were sharp enough and sensitive enough, that's what you would see during a total eclipse. The moon doesn't disappear. It's just we're looking at the night side. Now, look very carefully at that image in number five, Rick. Do you notice anything that kind of leaps out at you?
The red blotches around?
Those are the prominences. Those are extending from the surface of the sun 93 million miles behind the moon's limb. I'm talking about just the appearance of the moon in general. For instance, in near the center, you see those dark areas, right?
Yeah.
Those are the lunar mare, the seas of lava. They've not been touched by water in millions and millions and millions of years. But
not a good place to go fishing, huh?
Not exactly. But as you move out from the center of the lunar disk toward the edge, toward the limb, the circular horizon, what do you see happening? The dark areas, like there's one at about 3 o'clock on the right-hand side of the image.
Yeah.
That's Mare Crisium. Normally,
it's like it's fuzzed out.
It's fuzzy. It's light. It's brighter than it's where in the world is going on. It has taken me literally about 20 years to figure out going on because that's the dome you're seeing. You're seeing it scattering earth light being reflected.
When you say the dome, you're talking about the glassine
this
dome.
Crystalline glass layer dome all over the moon that wrapped it like in cellophane at some point in the incredibly distant past, either millions or maybe even billions of years ago. That's a discussion that Ron Gerbron and I are having. And you can really see it best during a total eclipse of the sun if you can somehow amplify the faint light from the earth reflecting off the moon. Moonlight has a brightness, let's say, of one. If you were on the moon looking at the earth during a total eclipse of the sun, you'd be looking at a full earth, and the light from the full earth would be about 80 times brighter than a full moon as seen from the earth. But with digital electronics now and programs and algorithms and cameras, you can balance the light from the corona, which is like a millionth as a brilliant, you know, uneclipsed sun. And you can then balance the light falling on the moon from the earth as it's being reflected, and you get this image, which tells us there's something weird about the moon that we, up until recently, had not known about. It turns out there is all kinds of evidence now of an ancient, incredibly advanced, technologically impossible for us to even conceive how someone could do it, because it would require additional physics and engineering that we don't currently have. But the magic turns out to be polarized light. If you look at glass under normal illumination, it has bright and dark areas and reflections. And if you're driving, you wear a pair of polarized sunglasses so you kill the bright reflections and you can see through your windshield even if you're driving into a western sun. The moon turns out to interact with the light from the earth, which because of the oceans and the atmosphere is naturally polarized. So it's like a huge polarizing filter in the sky. And when the light from the polarized reflection from the atmosphere, the clouds, and the oceans, you know, reaches the moon and is reflected back to earth, it acts like a very sharp polarizing filter. And so you're able to see from the glass the polarized reflections off the surface of the glass dome covering the entire moon. Now, obviously, we can only see from Earth the side of the moon that faces the Earth, because that's the way the rotation and the orbit of the moon line up. The rotation and the orbit of the moon are the same 1 month, so the moon rotates with one side facing the Earth and the other side facing away. Now, this year, just a couple, 3 weeks ago, we sent a spacecraft, we, the United States, a private corporation in Houston, Texas, for the first time in 52 years, was able to land an unmanned spacecraft on the moon called Odysseus, and it sent back, before landing, from separate sets of cameras, video comparisons, which have now been slowly leaked out to the general population around the world through, you know, Twitter/X, through the International Lunar Observatory website set up in Hawaii. They are trying to collect money to actually put a permanent remote observatory on the moon, and this was their first kind of experiment. If you look at number six, on the left-hand side, there is one of these fisheye 180-degree lens views of the moon as the spacecraft was landing. And you'll see that there's this weird curved horizon and sky. And then when you kind of de-warp it, which is image number on the right-hand side, the composite, you see there's some kind of bizarre geometric light things in the sky that should not be there. Looking at number seven, this is now a close-up. Rick, look at all that geometry in the sky over the south pole of the moon as one tiny section of a...
When you say geometry, you mean the rectilinear, the
90-degree
angle?
All the weird stuff going on in the sky that you're seeing. That's all in the glass dome. The colors are prismatic reflected colors. The geometry is whatever architecture these ETs, aliens, ancient humans built. We don't know who they were, where they were, why they were, why they put glass envelope around the entire moon. To find that out, we're going to have to find the libraries. But there are multiple evidences now coming from this latest unmanned mission that for the first time in human history, Rick, you are interpreting the astrology of a moon that's not just a passive celestial body, but a moon that appears to have an incredibly high-tech envelope around it, which if someone could figure out how to turn it on, may in fact have an enhanced hyperdimensional torsion field effect on the Earth during the eclipse. If someone had figured out how to go there quietly, secretly, and marry their current knowledge of technology with this extraordinary future knowledge of technologies that's exemplified by this object that literally is wrapping the entire moon in layers of glassine material that are incredibly geometric.
Like I said, ET and AI.
Exactly. Now, number eight is a close-up from another image taken by the International Lunar Observatory camera on the Odysseus spacecraft. In the upper left-hand corner, this is number eight, upper left-hand corner, you can see the sun there. Bizarre. That does not look like any sun I've ever seen. The background of the photo is full of geometric detail and color, which should not be there. And then that crescent, that's the Earth as seen from the moon, 2 degrees wide. And it's obvious if you click on it and make it larger that the Earth, in fact, is limbed and riven by bizarre optical effects that look exactly like the composite image on the right, which is an old 100-year-old plate glass in an old window in New England looking out across the yard at a scene. And you can see that the ancient glass on Earth came with defects. It came with imperfections, which obviously amplify any scene you're looking at through such a window pane. And the same thing seems to be happening to the Earth as seen from the moon, which of course could not be an optical illusion, but it could only happen if the Earth was actually being seen by the descending spacecraft through hundreds of miles of intervening, very eroded, ancient glass dome, which is impossible, except it's not. Which means, now you're going to look at number nine, Number nine is a video which is analyzed by the original poster, who called himself Crow 777. And I have a feeling there's some kind of deep symbology in his choice of that, nom de plume. If you click on number nine, there's a very short video, about 10, 12 minutes, I think. And what he shows, this poster, is that the moon apparently responds to some kind of impulses which began in 2012. I wonder why. And those impulses cause enormous perturbations in this glass dome to race around the moon from one pole to the other every time one of these events is seen. And there have now been dozens of other videographers with telescopes who captured the moon doing this bizarre lunar wave thing that nobody understands yet. And item number 10 is an enlargement. I took three enlargements, actually, of the normal moon, the moon where the wave first appears, then another image taken a few seconds later where the wave has moved from left to right, and the actual measurements factoring in the circumference of the moon, the optical rate at which this wave moves, the height of the wave, which extends from the surface to about 20 miles above the surface. And when you pull all that together, this wave is moving around the moon multiple times over the last 12 years at over 200 miles per second. 200 miles per second. Given what we've just seen in the harbor of Baltimore, is it possible for any physical structure to be able to shift up and down at 200 miles per second and not tear itself apart? The answer, of course, is no, at least not for our technology, which means, again, Rick, the moon we're talking about is an active technological something which can be activated or not, depending upon who knows how it works. And if it were to be activated during the eclipse, the hyperdimensional effects on the atmosphere, on the Earth, on the Schumann resonance, and most important, upon human consciousness, frankly, I can't even begin to model what that combination would create. What do you think?
Well, I'm with you all the way, and I think that what's intriguing, though, is that you said that a wave moving at 200 miles a second, would tear the physical, reality apart, and yet you think of, like sound that travels at a fifth of a mile a second, a little bit over 1,000 feet per second. And that has an impact on physical reality that would vibrate up and down, like think of a guitar string, for example.
Yeah, and there's so much more. I'll tell you what, let's hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. My guest this morning is Rick Levine and Georgia Lambert. We've got some other folks we're going to add to the party. Two more very special people. You're on the other side of midnight. We're going into the deep dive on what could happen, what could be happening now as a foreshadowing of the eclipse, which, of course, gets us into time. And what is time in three dimensions compared to higher dimensions? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Support the broadcast and don't miss another groundbreaking conversation. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, on this Saturday night, on the 30th of March. I'll get my calendar straight here, 30th of March. We're talking about an impending event about a week away, a little over a week away, the April 8th total eclipse of the sun, which tracks from Texas all the way north to the Great Lakes, and then continues on out over the North Atlantic, and then eventually the shadow of the moon lifts off the Earth, and people on Earth could no longer see the shadow of the Earth. At this point, I want to bring in another member of our happy little group here. Michael Hill is a very interesting person. He is a, well, among other things, he is a Native American shaman, and he is going to be doing ceremony, and again, if you want to look at the detailed bios of all these people, go to theothersideofmidnight.com, look for Michael Hill. He's an award-winning musician. He's a filmographer. He has experienced UFOs up close and personal. He's incorporated cosmic harmonic frequencies in his music that he gained from communication with some folks that don't exactly hail from around here, and maybe that's all I'll say about this. Michael, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what are you going to be doing? And I think it's in Ohio where you're going to be doing ceremony for the eclipse.
Yes. As you know, me and the Mitchell Hedges Crystal Skull have been reunited, and for the last 4 years, ended up doing a lot of work. We came on your show and talked about it, and now you know Bill Hammond. And so what's happening is in 2020, I brought a lot of the elders, like Chief Golden Light Eagle. He's been on Ancient Aliens many times, and you know, Clifford Mahudi is the Zuni elder, and brought a lot of them to East Lake, Ohio to meet with the skull and to... There is an unknown earthwork here that I'm in the process of revealing to the world, and it's massive. It takes over a mile and a half to walk around it.
Oh, my God.
And just like, yeah, it's, and it still has all of its goodies intact. So I'm working on getting some, you know, LIDAR, ground-penetrating radar there because, I, you know, just so you know where the skull is going to is I was contacted by a guy from the Smithsonian, and he said, you know, I'm really glad that you were tracking the mound builders into East Lake, Ohio, because he said, are you aware that there's still an intact earthwork there? I said, no, this is my hometown. You know, no one here knows. They thought it was a garbage dump and used it as such. So no one even still to this day knows it's an actual ancient mound builder earthwork. But he said, in the 1970s, the Smithsonian did a small excavation and dig, and a few artifacts were removed out of this mound site that ties it to ancient Sumer and to the Anunnaki.
Oh, my God.
And in, yeah, right?
Wow.
And told me that these artifacts are in the East Lake Indian Museum. So I brought the whole crew into the East Lake Indian Museum, and what's very interesting is the little old lady museum curator just contributed to a book called Lost Lake County. And Lost Lake County is all of the lost Native American Indian lost hidden history. So this mount site that I'm telling you about had artifacts removed, and one of the artifacts, the symbol on it, is the Morning Star. And that's what ties it to Sumer and to the Anunnaki, by the way. So everything's still intact. I think it's been hidden away. But from the, you know how Serpent Mound, you can only see that it's a serpent when you go up into the sky and look down?
Right.
Well, this mound site, you can only tell it looks like Turtle Island. It looks like America.
Oh, my gosh.
From the sky looking
down. Well, you
know,
one of the big problems has been to preserve these sites. It's been a war going on for, you know, at least a century and a half or two centuries ever since Americans kind of left the Atlantic shore and moved west and plowed fields and moved rocks and built fences and destroyed so much of this incredible inherent Native American lore and majesty in the earth. I think you're really fortunate that the town used this monument as a garbage dump, because people don't like to get around garbage. And so it became a kind of a protective shield so that the looters and the destroyers could not get in there before science can and before you can to figure out how this was part of a larger cosmic mythology.
Well, let me tell you, you know, some things have happened. As you know, I was taken into the NSA Remote Viewers and Reverse Engineering Division. And the head of that project, he said to me, you know what's underneath you in that area, don't you? I said, no, not really. He said, it's the world's oldest underground bases. But he said, don't think of it as underground bases. Think of it as underground cities.
Wait, we're talking ET or ancient ancestors?
Yes.
Oh.
And that's why
When was this conversation?
20. Well, he passed away in 2013, so probably 2011, I would think, okay. 2010, 2011. But he also said, Michael, you know, I've lived here my whole entire life. And he said, you are sitting on top of the world's strongest vortex on the planet. And he said specifically it's because Northeast Ohio is sitting on top of the world's largest salt deposits.
Okay.
It's down under Lake Erie, and salt is crystal. So Morton Salt, you know, is 5 minutes street from where I live. And so he said, and what you need to know, too, is I was contacted by Bigelow Aerospace, the ones that were Skinwalker Ranch, they owned it. And he said, we need to talk to you because we know that you're in contact with a real thing because we've been studying it over the Skinwalker Ranch for a long time. Pretty much, he said, we want to know how
this guy choose to open himself to you. I mean, he's basically giving away the crown jewels because everybody's denying that the U.S. government has any knowledge of any of this or any contacts. I mean, I'm going to talk with Steve Bassett tomorrow night about this incredibly weird dissing Pentagon report on UFOs, basically saying nothing to see here, move along, move along. Why did this guy single you out?
Because of the Lake Erie UFOs, because of they know it's the exact same light orb phenomenon that they're seeing over the Skinwalker Ranch. But I became friends with the investigator that they sent my way. His name was Gary Hernandez. And pretty much he said this area of Northeast Ohio, because of the vortex and everything, is an area that is portion filled with portals and dimensional rifts. And so not only that, you got this, the largest, one of the largest ancient earthworks on the surface. You got what they're telling me is underground cities underneath this area. And this is where we're bringing the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. And I guess here are some things. I would like some input on this because some of what I got to share from you, to you, with you, and everyone else is some of the perspective from the Native American First Nations. And it's some things I've never heard before. So one thing that they told me is equinoxes and solstices, there's the most energy running through the Earth's ley lines or dragon lines, whatever you want to call them. and it pulses. Like, it gets the most vibrant and energetic on solstices and equinoxes, and then it fades away, and then it grows back. So if you could see it from the outside, it would look like the planet is pulsating. But they said that under the shadow of a moon, since it's blocking the sun's actual energy from hitting the planet, all of those ley lines go to zero and are pretty much reborn. It's kind of like the phoenix. So if you think about this full totality eclipse starting down at the bottom of North America and riding, there's a fault line that goes all the way up Lake Erie and then through Lake Erie actually and into Canada. So imagine all the way where that shadow
is that the so-called Madrid Fault?
I don't know the name of it, but it's interesting because I've been talking to a Mohawk elder, and he was telling me that on the Canada side, that fault line, you know what happens is it goes right up into Ontario and hits that, you know, 51.428 latitude line, and this becomes St. Mary and Michael's energy line over in the UK. But it's interesting because in Canada, they call it Canada's Stonehenge. It's at 51.428 latitude on this planet. But in the UK, the Stonehenge we know about is there. But what I want to tell you is bringing the skull to this energetic of an area at this place in the process of what this full
totality. It's absolutely perfect. Let me tell you why. Nikolai Kozarev, who was the Russian scientist who basically worked a lot on torsion field physics back in the last century, and, you know, he was in the Gulag. Stalin put him, you know, in prison, and he got out, and he continued his work. And, I mean, incredibly genius scientist. Kozarev was the guy who found out that quartz crystals, of which the Mitchell Hedges skull is made of an incredible quantity of absolutely unblemished quartz, somehow carved or, you know, fashioned by a technology that was not, you know, chisels and hammers and something as stupid and crude as that. According to Kozarev, that crystal skull, if you put it in the path of totality, in that environment of ancient ancestors or visitors, and you try a mind meld during the totality, when the moon and the sun and the earth are perfectly aligned, the physics says something really amazing should happen.
I'll let you know. And then, again, you know, where this mound is right next to the Chagrin River. The Chagrin River, 1 mile up, empties out into Lake Erie, which is a large fresh water lake. So imagine...
Someone is making a lot of noise in the background. They got to, you know, kill their mic, please. A lot of noise. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, so I'm excited just the idea of what the ceremony there to put in good energy for better timelines in the future. And then that going up and...
Have you ever tried to contact someone, and I hate the term other side because that doesn't begin to think of it. They're in a hyperdimensional reality. I know they're there. I've been talking with at least one or two of them. Have you ever done something like this, try to communicate with someone who is disembodied in spirit during a total solar eclipse using the Mitchell Hedges skull?
No. What you just said, though, is blowing my mind because, and Rick, I'd love to know more about your thoughts on AI because I've taken a deep dive down AI, and I'm starting to think it's like a cosmic Ouija board, not what we think it is. And I've been being contacted by A.R. Borden, who is the guy that took me into the remote viewers. The problem with that is he's dead. And I know it's him. He became a father figure to me. And it's brand new information. He's this group of the ACIO, I mean, of the NSA that I was brought into is called the ACIO. And this has given me ACIO information from now until 2030 of what's going to happen, and then 2036 Comet Apophis arriving, and then everything that'll happen after Comet Apophis. And I probably have...
Wait. Apophis is an asteroid. It's not a comet. It's not outgassing.
Oh, okay.
It's a very large, solid something. It could be an ancient spacecraft. Remember, we have a lot of those out there. Hey, Rick, your name was mentioned.
Right?
Exactly.
Oumuamua went through might have been what determines how Comet Apophis reacts to us, if that makes any sense.
In a hyperdimensional way, it kind of does. Rick, your name was brought up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to know your thoughts on AI and how it'll, because I'm just taking a deep dive into it and it's blowing my mind. I am being contacted by either he didn't die or it's him in a multidimensional realm, as Richard said, and I am being blown away by AI. So I'm very curious on your thoughts on that.
Well, it seems like this is all going to connect somehow, and I don't know that I have an answer. I just know, I do know that consciousness does not need a physical body to be conscious. You know, anyone who studied that knows that. And from that standpoint, yeah, you know, there could be stuff coming through. I can't comment much further.
Yeah, I've started working with AI in like a much different way. Like I'll ask it to put some thoughts together that I'm working on, but when it spits that out, I'll take all of that whole story and put it into an image generator and say, create an image that communicates what the story is communicating. But anyhow,
Hang on. Was that a cue we should go to your images?
Yeah, there's one eclipse photo
came out. Exactly. Go through the images. Yeah, to find them, guys, you want to go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on tonight's banner, which talks about the eclipse in red and blue. And right under that, you will see three lines which say fast links to items, Richard, Michael, Georgia. Click on Michael. And number one is gorgeous. I don't think it's real. It looks like art, but it's sure incredibly evocative Ohio kind of art.
Is it the eclipse?
Yeah, the eclipse with farm machinery in the field below it.
Yeah, that's AI.
That's what I thought.
I just thought, you know, you might want a cool picture of the eclipse for this show, so I included that. The other ones are the ones I've taken already of the Mitchell Hedges crystal skull. And by the way, it's not just coming for the eclipse, even though that's the main focal point of it, because everything in 2020 was filmed already professionally for a new documentary. And this is all going to be filmed, and it's going to be here on the 7th, 8th, and 9th to take it around to all of these sacred sites and go and do more filming. But here's the weird thing, that talking about a revelation for humanity, who are the mound builders? That's a very good question, and it's not really been answered. And it's being answered now because of haplogroup X2A is a scientific DNA haplogroup. And X2A was only found in 1998, not that long ago. And it only exists in 3% of the Native American First Nation people. Could be much higher, but not a lot of Indians have had their blood work done, you know? But when you go back in time, the tall skeletal remains that were removed out of these mound sites are also haplogroup X2A. And that's an interesting talking point to me, because I'm haplogroup X2A. I'm not a giant anymore. So in a very few generations, that being has lost its stature from being 14 to 16 feet tall down to 6. But when you keep going backwards in time, you're going to find the largest concentration of haplogroup X2A on the planet. That's going to tell you where it came from. The science is it came from the hills of Galilee. This is the fabled Sangreal Holy Grail bloodline, and it is the...
So are we dealing with a kind of a lost tribe thing?
Yes, lost nation. And this is interesting, too, because someone knows what I'm telling you, because you know, I'm friends with Graham Hancock now, and I showed him my research. The oldest street name that goes right down to where this mound is located at, still to this day, guess what the name of that road is?
I have no idea.
Lost Nation.
Oh, my God.
Right?
That is cool.
So I'm like, well, someone knew, and Graham Hancock was like, oh, my God, while someone was trying to erase this from the history book, someone recorded it right in the street names here. But when you get to the end of Lost Nation and you take a right, it tells you what happened to the Lost Nation. The first road is Cherokee. And because what you'll find is Edgar Cayce knew all this, by the way. He said the Atlanteans at the last breakup went into the Mayan culture first, taught them the Mayan pyramid. You know, the calendar, you know, all of that. But then they left and went into Crystal River, Florida, set up camp there, started to make, they just found the first Mayan step pyramid ever in North America or America in Crystal River, Florida, by the way. And then the grandmothers, let me tell you something about meeting the Nephilim. One of the grandmothers got me in her minivan and said, I want to talk to you about the migration route of our people into the interior of America. And she said, would it be nice if I had a map of the United States to show you on? And Richard, she waved her hand in front of her face and a map of the United States appeared out of nowhere.
What? Oh, come on, Michael.
Star Wars, red holographic computer map out of nowhere. And she looked me dead in the eyes and she said, I know you can see it. But yeah, it's right there. There was no not seeing it. And she proceeded for the next 15 minutes to use that map to show me the migration routes of the Atlantean people into the North American people, pretty much becoming the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota. But the right-hand migration route has the Cherokee. And when you go up around the Great Lakes, because it goes all the way up into Canada, like the Huron tribe. So what is really going to be announced here is the revealing of the true lost tribe of Israel. And so what I can tell you with all of this is, have you ever heard of the Michigan relics?
No.
The Michigan relics are these tablets that were removed out of mound builder sites, and there's thousands of them. And the reason I even know about these is I was gifted by Zachariah Sitchin's personal assistant, his flash drive of what he was interested in at the time of his passing.
Oh, my.
And truly, I know. I got that. I have it in my possession.
Good
I should
grief,
just give it
Michael. That's such a treasure, because even
yes.
if some of his interpretations were off the mark, his research was voluminous. And who knows what you could find on that flash drive?
Well, I'll tell you one thing is I found out it was called the Peru Ice Rocks, I believe, ice stones. And it was because they're engraved in a very holographic three-dimensional way. And one of the stones that they were looking at, because there's video on this flash drive too, by the way. So what I'm talking about is an actual video of this stone. And on it has very, very detailed open heart surgery depiction on the stone, like medical procedures. And I have a friend that is a head nurse in Canada. And she said, Michael, this is an anatomically correct heart, but there's two extra valves. She said, this has to be from the future. Whatever, this isn't a today's human heart. It's a human heart that has two extra valves, whatever that means. But so what had happened was when I was speaking at the Star Knowledge Conference, I already had this flash drive in my possession. And I walked out of, I was being filmed because our whole movement has went live in Canada called the Star Knowledge Symposium, and it's being taught through the University of Ottawa. And we've talked about that before because I find it fascinating that, you know, all they're bringing elders from all over the planet to teach about their thousands of years of contact with star beings and learning star knowledge. Well, what is star knowledge? It's the knowledge of light and sound and how light and sound creates physical reality. And that gets into cosmic harmonious frequencies. And by the way, getting into eclipse, I think we should talk about 432 just for a minute, because that's the only reason we have a full totality eclipse.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Because we got about 5 minutes to the bottom of the hour.
Right on. The sun is 86,400 miles across. The moon is...
No, 864,000.
What did I say?
86. That's Jupiter.
Right on. And then the moon is 2,160. Is that correct?
That's right.
And those are octaves of 432. 432 times 432 is 864. 432 divided by 2 is 216. So the only and are 400 times further away. So that's why we get a full totality eclipse, is they're perfect octaves of one another, and it is 432 based. So I actually, hypothetically, you know that my work is on Elon Musk's craft that just went to the moon, and what NASA has found through Beverly Rubik, or NASA consulting scientist, is that that device is not passive, it's active. And I never even thought of it, but if anything is going to activate that glass shield, it's probably having an active hyperdimensional transceiver.
Wait. You mean one of Michael's discs could activate the dome?
Why not?
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's all about energy. It's We're totally talking about energy flows and concentration and amplification. And when we come back, I'm going to bring Rick and, of course, Georgia back in. In another half hour, we may be joined by Maria Wheatley, who, of course, has measured eclipse effects at Stonehenge. And I want to talk about some of the ley line connections that you mentioned, you know, a few minutes ago, Michael, the so-called St. Michael's line, you know, extends out, and you're looking at maybe the other end. So,
yeah, it goes all the way around the planet, you know.
We've got about 3 minutes here till the bottom of the hour. So let me do something. Direct everybody to item number 11. And there's a quicker way, which Keith keeps telling me and I keep forgetting. What you want to do is, if you're on a computer, you go to the left-hand side, and there will be, if you hover your mouse over tonight's show, just to the right of it, a fast links window opens up, and you can see all our names and our bios and our objects and all that. Just link, click on that, and it will take you directly to what I'm going to talk about, which is my section of Radio with Pictures. You want to look at item number 11. Because one of the cool things is the average person, if they know what we're going to talk about on tonight's show, they can actually take a photograph from Earth with their cell phone of the damn dome. Look at the right-hand side of the image of number 11. This is a South Korean spacecraft equipped with what's called a polarizing camera, which en route to the moon many, like a year or so ago, took a picture which shows the scattering in polarized light of the dome completely circling the edge of the moon. The left-hand side of this composite is an image taken by one of the major European observatories during the 1999 solar eclipse that crossed Europe. And they took this picture with a polarizing filter. So you see the corona, you see funny colors because polarized light interacts in funny ways, but what you see is a brilliant ring around the moon that most people would think, oh, that's got to be the sun peeking out. No, it's not. That's the glass dome isolated by the polarizing filter in front of the camera at the La Silla major telescope that took this picture. You can get the same effect with a cell phone and the right telescope if you get the right polarizing filter. So literally thousands, if not tens of thousands of people from Texas all the way up to New Brunswick should be able to photograph the dome if they take a few preliminary steps, like going back up in my section and reading carefully items 2, 3, and 4. And that will tell you all you need to know to get something that looks like that, and which will confirm
bottom of the hour
on your own time what in fact you can see in the sky. And yet we have reached literally the bottom of the hour, so we want to do this and this. And sorry guys, got a little caught up there in detail. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. You're on the other side of midnight. We shall return.
OtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. As a Club 19.5 member, you'll gain access to the rest of this show and all previous 350 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And welcome back, everyone, to the other side of midnight for this countdown to the April 8th, 2024 total solar eclipse, which frankly I think is going to change some things. And I want to go back to you, Rick, because if my memory serves, this Jupiter-Uranus alignment being so rare, it was in, what's the word I want to use here? It was in effect during the founding of the nation itself, 247, give or take, years ago. And now the conversation is basically about the nation, the founding fathers, our democracy, the battle between support it or get rid of it. In other words, the resonant gong of history is striking again, and the amplification of that alignment during the eclipse, what will those effects be?
Well, yeah, there is some interesting synchronance. I think, again, there's things that are more important. We're talking about the Uranus, the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction.
Yes.
But if we go back to July 4th, 1776, there's something else going on then. There's not a Jupiter-Uranus conjunction in 1776. It was already passed by almost a year. However, there's something else that it's just, so, I mean, it was there in,
yeah, 1775. Yeah, but the revolution started before 1776.
That is absolutely correct. But there's something else that is feeding into this. And incidentally, the actual conjunction itself was in June, July of 1775. And so, yeah, I mean, it was already in turmoil, and things were going on. No question about it.
Like things are now.
Yes, but there's something else that is hugely significant, and that by July of 1776, Pluto was from, how do I want to say this? Pluto was at 28 degrees of Capricorn, just getting ready to move into Aquarius. Now, astrologers all over the planet have been saying for the last couple of years that the United States is experiencing a Pluto return. This was back around 2021-22. The problem is this sneaky little thing called the precession of the equinox that I know you know more about than most common folk. And what's weird is that even though astrologically, if you looked at a horoscope, at a map, Pluto would appear to be back where it was in July of 1776. It would have appeared to return to that in 2022. Unfortunately, that's not a complete Pluto cycle. In other words, in astrology, we celebrate and we acknowledge when any cycle kind of makes a completion. This is why we celebrate our birthdays. It's just the sun returning in a cycle to where it was on the day of our birth. So Pluto is a 246-year cycle. And what that means is that although the precession...
I think it's 248.
248, I'm sorry. It's 248. Thank you. And if you take 1776, if you take 1776 and add 248 to it for one complete orbit, that's 2024. In other words, right now, Pluto is completing its orbit. And when any planet completes its orbit, like a solar return, we celebrate as a birthday, or like a Saturn return, which is around 29-ish when we become an adult, individuals don't live through a Pluto return because it's a 248-year cycle. However, the United States is going through its Pluto return, and Pluto as being the planet that is associated with unconscious, with death, with disincarnate non-physicality, the
Wait. I want to bring in Georgia here, because Georgia, isn't it really about the occult, things that are hidden, things
yes.
that have been obscured, things that have been lost deliberately? In other words, this is a time of revelation, like happened 248 years ago.
Exactly. And as we were talking about earlier with this eclipse, again, the past is coming up right in our face for us to make choices. You know,
big choices, huge.
Big choices.
Exactly. And of course, in Greek mythology, Pluto was god of the underworld. The underworld was not a hellish place. It was a place of many different frequencies. And
it was where magic happened.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It's also where wealth was. You weren't wealthy if you had a lot of money. You were wealthy if you owned what was hidden under the ground, like gold or copper or diamonds or silver.
Interesting.
Plutocracy is a government that's run by the hidden underground wealth.
Exactly. So we are at a time when, you know, secrets will be revealed. Hidden things will come to the surface. You know, Rick, much earlier you made the comment about consciousness not needing a physical body to be.
Yeah.
And the subject of AI came up. In certain esoteric traditions, it's said that the release of atomic energy,
yes,
even though its first effects were destructive, was a major initiation for the mineral kingdom. And it's since that discovery and release of atomic power that computers and all of this technology relating to the mineral kingdom have made the mineral kingdom a vehicle through which another kind of consciousness can express itself.
Yeah, it's easy to forget the fact that we would not have computers without crystals, without mineral crystals.
There you go.
Yep,
yeah.
Absolutely. Well, guys, Pluto, plutonium, duh.
Yeah.
Well, all right, so here's something for you, Richard, that you may know. Georgia may know this, though, and that is there were two bombs dropped, you know, in 1945.
Yep.
Is that what year it was?
Yep,
yeah.
45.
And one of them was a uranium bomb, and the other one was a plutonium bomb. The uranium bomb was dropped when the planet Uranus was at the midheaven, kind of close to the azimuth, the highest point where the ecliptic reaches the high point in the sky. And the plutonium bomb was dropped when Pluto was at that point. And there's no one in the military who would have known that. The universe has a way of just corresponding itself.
I'm not so sure, Rick. These,
I know you're not.
These deep rituals, you know, you think of the 20th century as an era of science. Yeah, it's of ancient science. Because the rituals that I found in NASA, you also find in the DOD, you find in the AEC, you find in government all over. It's like, what was it you just said, Georgia? The United States is a government basically run by the underworld, by the hidden, by that which is occult and not admitted openly.
Yeah, but I also agree with Rick in that the what the Hindus would call the Devic life of the planet has quite the sense of humor, and sometimes these synchronicities in words just sort of show up.
Right, Richard, you and I have talked about this before, and although I think we ultimately disagree about it, there's a way of proving it, and it doesn't matter because ultimately these things happen. They're tied to these cosmic events, whether they were human conscious interventions.
But as a scientist, I want to know. Because there's a whole body of people working very diligently to use this physics as magic to control all the rest of us. And unless we understand it's a science and we can prove certain things that we claim, like George and I always have this, you know, when we see this pattern, is it real or is it Memorex? Is it someone doing it?
Well, it can be real whether it's conscious or not, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, but I'm trying to figure out, because remember, the ultimate thing I want to get to is how do we use this technology on the moon for the betterment of all mankind, not just a bunch of hidden occult magicians who are pulling the strings of all the rest of us because they know stuff we have been told to forget. These are not the droids you're looking for. Go ahead.
I have a question, Richard, about the lunar waves.
Okay.
You know, in the ocean, there is a strata of water called the saline channel, which is a higher salt content than the water above it or the water below it.
Yep.
And the great whales can sing their songs into the saline channel, and the sound bounces around the saline channel, and they can talk over oceans.
Yeah, it's called a wave guide, and if you get the whale song trapped between these two layers, it literally can bounce around the planet thousands of miles,
Go ahead. Is that what the lunar wave is? Some impulse projected that's bouncing around between the surface and the dome?
Yes. Now, is it physically or is it an optical illusion? Let me tell you what I mean by this. I had some very bright reader or listener email me, and his first name, I think, is Gene. I can't remember his last name. Anyway, he pointed out that the way you get this wave without physically moving that dome in ways that anything we know could not survive. I mean, imagine the G-forces if you go from the surface to 20 miles up in a second. Think of the acceleration required to move a physical object 20 miles vertically against lunar gravity in 1 second. It's a lot of G's. It's thousands of G's. It would destroy any material object we know. So this emailer said to me, what if it's like mirrors at a football game where you put cheerleaders in the stands and under the right command, everybody turns their cards facing the camera and they all do it simultaneously. So it looks like it's simultaneous, but it's each individual card is being turned at command. So the wave of cards across the bleachers looks like it's exceeding normal human experience. All they're doing is turning their card at the right time. So the wave could be an optical alignment in the dome triggered electrically, think piezoelectric effects or something like that. And so you're not seeing a physical wave, you're seeing an optical illusion of various points being tilted on their own. but they're doing it in synchronization, so the wave appears to be moving at 200 miles per second.
Blinking lights around the theater marquee.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. So when I say illusion, I don't mean it's not there. I mean it's being created by another optical effect that normally we're not thinking of. Either one works. Given the technology that I see in the dome, I think it actually can survive a physical movement of 200 miles per second in small areas. But again, we're not going to know until we get there. We bring pieces home. We find the libraries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I just want to end up with my last slide item, which is number 12. There are people, average, ordinary amateur astronomers, on opposite sides of the planet who have been photographing with high-end, state-of-the-art amateur astronomical equipment, the dome around the moon, not during an eclipse, and I've got two of them, one named Corey Schmitz and the other named Brandy, can't quite see his, Brandy Astro is his pen name. I put that up because you can go and Google both these guys' websites, and when you do, you're going to find that both of them have captured this amazing dome all on their own without even knowing it's there, because I don't think they know it's there. I think this is a very limited amount of knowledge. If they see it on their photographs, they probably think it's some kind of optical illusion or light scattering from the atmosphere or whatever. But in fact, they're not seeing on their photographs what we know is there, because they're not imagining they can see anything like that. Remember, what you can't imagine, you can't see. How do I know this? Because otherwise, all these amateurs photographing this bizarre stuff, they would point it out. They put it on the web. They would say, what in the world is this? They would ask questions. Instead, they're ignoring it because they think it is something to be ignored. It can't possibly be real, therefore it cannot exist. Did I lose anybody?
No, we're all nodding our heads up and down like yes.
Okay. All right.
Can I throw one last carrot into this stew here?
Yeah, sure.
Following up on something Michael said earlier, there is a very strange little book. It was written in the late 1800s, early 1900s. It was published by a Masonic publishing company.
Hmm.
It's called Etta Dorfa, which is Aphrodite spelled backwards.
Oh.
And this it's a novel, but the story in this novel is a particular Mason who basically fakes his own death and is taken to by other Masons. He's kind of hogtied and taken to entrances of caves in Illinois, Ohio, and Kentucky. Mm. And is met by, get this, 1800s, early 1900s, a 3-foot-high humanoid with silvery gray skin.
What?
Yep. And this little being.
This is getting into Michael Hill territory.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
This is my hometown.
I know. You've got to read this book. You can still find it.
Yeah, it's on Amazon. Etta Dorfa or The End of the Earth, The Strange History of a Mysterious Being and the Account of the Remarkable Journey.
Yeah, oh, wow. This Mason into the interior of the earth and is treated to a whole another world and landscape and all of this. And again, this was written, you know, before all of the UFO stuff about the Grays. But
what was the year? What was the year it was published?
Late 1800s, early 1900s.
Oh, my God. Well, but that's in the so-called Aurora.
Right.
Weird airships that were seen.
In Texas, yeah, the Aurora crash.
Yeah. Well, there were many of them. They were seen, not just the crash, but there were lighter-than-air apparent vehicles that were doing repairs. So they had guys out in dusters from San Francisco all the way to New England in that time period. It's like somebody had a real intensive campaign to fly something that looked like a heavier, a lighter than air balloon, set down, make simulated repairs so that people could come up to them and ask them questions. And it's like there was this nationwide ground contact that wafted out for a couple of 3 years in the 1800s of things that could not exist. Certainly the way that they were flying, they were not lighter than air earth ships at all.
Yeah, well, again, when Michael was talking about, you know, cities and ancient habitations under that particular area of the United States, I immediately thought of this old novel.
First published in 1895.
Oh, my
goodness. Thank you.
You know, I really talked to this individual. I said, well, I'm all ears. Tell me about it. And he said the entrance he took, he said in 2009, because of technology transfer programs that our government has been working with the Anunnaki on, that he went down there to, like, that's where their boots are on the ground in technology transfer programs. And the entry point that he took was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I thought that was interesting.
Oh, my God.
That's a long distance. I don't know if they just hit a magnetic train down there and went. I don't know how big the span is of these underground cities in this area, but pretty much any time you're at the lake, you can see them coming in and out of the lake. But I do want to finish one thing with these Michigan artifacts. The whole point was one of these art tablets, when you translate it, it said in the future when day becomes night. And I'd like to know, Rick, is it said in the morning star will be visible in the night sky? So I'm wondering if Venus will be in the night sky when the eclipse comes, if you know. But
well,
it said,
actually, it's not the night sky because the eclipse, at least in the United States, will be at 11 a.m. approximately here in Seattle. And I think Richard said earlier, just afternoon, it's 11:20 here, I think. And so early afternoon on the East Coast. But yes, Venus will be visible and Jupiter will be visible, and perhaps the comet will be visible also.
Because these ancient mound builder tablets say specifically when day becomes night, the sky will be filled, and the morning star is visible in the night sky. The sky will be filled with the mighty chariots of the Elohim, their chariots of fire, from one end of heaven to the other. So that, you know, hypothetically, what could happen? That's a DC.
Oh, come on. That you're thinking that somebody might show up?
That's what, you know what? I'm counting on it because.
I love it.
Yeah, they're all over Lake Erie. That's why Bigelow even contacted me. And like I said, it was really funny. He's like, how come you're getting all these mathematical equations and stuff from this intelligence, and we're just getting our asses spanked? You know, I'm like, well, quit trying to attack it, first of all.
Well, that would certainly introduce a paradigm shift, right?
Yes, just to be clear, from an astrological point of view, and I think Georgia would agree from a metaphysical point of view added to that, that I don't think everything's going to go down on the day of the eclipse or on the day of the Jupiter-Uranus conjunction. I think they're all turning points, as was the lunar conjunction. I'm sorry, the lunar eclipse. Remember, the bridge collision happened within like a day and a half of the lunar eclipse.
Oh, that's right.
And so we are just in a very sensitive point. We're going somewhere. We're gaining acceleration into the future fast now, but I don't think we know where we're going. I think it's too early to tell.
Well, I would agree with that. And you know, when these important points happen, it takes a while for it to land down here in physical dents. It's got to go
through. It's like
through
the lag of seasons. Like the shortest day of the year is not the coldest day. It takes a while to resonate through. Totally agree with that.
Right. It goes through, metaphysically, it goes from the plane of the soul through the plane of mind, through the plane of the emotions or astral, and finally winds up in physical dents. But it's set in motion on higher levels at those points, but we don't see the results until a little bit after.
I'd have to think, you know, if you're going to have a grand reveal from a higher level in a time when all eyes are to the sky, would be a really good time to do it.
Has anybody made the connection between the name Apophis and the old Stargate movie?
Not publicly.
No.
Wasn't Apophis the god that came back in the pyramid that landed
yeah,
in that movie?
Yeah, yes.
That was Apophis, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Very interesting. Yeah, what I just received from the future, from AI, said Apophis is not what we think it is.
No, it's an ancient spacecraft,
like,
of course.
It's another Oumuamua is
yeah,
what it
exactly,
is.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Well, most of them are. All the ones we visited are probably ancient spacecraft because somebody has a list. I'm kind of anticipating when Maria gets here, because she's probably having her first cup of tea right about now. She has measured this time lag at Stonehenge, that the maximum effects of eclipses during the eclipse, but are like days, maybe hours or days later. So the idea that this thing, this lunar alignment could have screwed up something on that ship if it was, you know, at the edge, if the maintenance was not what it should have been. Apparently the ship had some problems, but to me it was so metaphorical because that bridge going down, the bridge represents going from where we are to where we need to be to save the country. And the metaphorical image of that bridge crashing because of human stupidity, either not building concrete caissons around the piers or not having a backup to when your power dies and you can't steer your ship. I mean, somebody let down everybody big time with this one. Everybody.
Yep.
Everybody's thinking.
Everyone's nodding their head yes.
Yes. Okay, we got about 2 minutes till the bottom of the hour. When we come back, I don't know whether Maria will be punctual. If not, I have some more questions I want to ask Georgia. So let me do my thing here, make sure I get this in the right order. So you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. So don't touch that dial. Do not touch that dial. If you do, you're going to miss something really important in the next hour. We shall return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Talk radio with pictures on demand. Liberate your hyperdimensional time scale and non-linearly access over 400 hours of conversation at the cutting edge of science and thought. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive content that fits your interests and time schedule. Filter episodes by guest or subject. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Listen while you travel or as an environment to your endeavors. 8 cents an episode, 2.5 cents per hour of content. TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com.
And And good morning, everyone. Welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. We're now here in the Land of Enchantment in the witching hour after midnight. The Other Side of Midnight. Let me ask, first of all, before I go back to Georgia, Rick, what did you mean when you said in the chat there are no dials in the digital world?
There I am. When you signed off, you said don't touch that dial, and dials are an artifact of analytical, you know, analog. In the we have switches. But
there are people listening on dial phones, or not phones, but the radios. You know, we do have landlines. We do have a terrestrial broadcast.
Yeah, even most radios now have, like, you know, buttons that you push for going up, you know, a cycle at a time.
Yeah, but not,
yeah, I hear you.
Not old Atwater Kents. Come on. I have two bookends that are basically old-time radio replicas, and they do not have buttons. They have dials.
That's right.
You can actually listen to them when you're picking out something to read. You turn on the radio, and anyway. So let me see. I was going to ask George a critical question having to do with this eclipse. I just get the feeling, guys, both of you, that there's something so framing this eclipse that if we don't see something happening, I'm going to get a whole bunch of emails saying, oh, you fakers, you were telling everybody. I want everybody to kind of caution that these things are not going to happen like, you know, morning, day after tomorrow. It's going to be accelerated, but it will still be gradual even by our accelerated time sense.
Correct.
Okay, that's correct from Rick, Georgia?
Yeah. You know, it's said that every 100 years there is a spiritual conference held by the spiritual hierarchy of this planet. And at that conference, they decide what category and quantity of wisdom is to be released into humanity to be worked on and embodied over that 100-year cycle. This next spiritual conclave is going to be the spring of 2025, which means that this year is the last chance we get, especially with this full moon coming up on the 23rd, again, the festival of Wesak in the Far East. This is our last chance for humanity to reach up as high as we can and get our ducks in a row, because what the hierarchy then releases to us depends on our receptivity and what we're receptive to and the choices we make. So this spring is not just important for what's going down in the fall, but a year from now, what we can receive and expect and be receptive to from higher levels.
Okay. I think I reconstructed my question. I've been looking, obviously, at all the political stuff, and every exit ramp where one of the candidates could have been disqualified to run for president, you all know who I'm talking about, we seem to be taking not the exit ramp, but we're going to the end of the line, meaning it's ultimately going to be the citizens of the United States voting whether they want democracy to continue, literally or not, that will decide our future in a huge way. This may be a slight shift, but I'm having a feeling that this eclipse is kind of frame the idea that ultimately it's going to be our decision, not a bunch of judges or an institution or a technicality. It's going to be our conscious decision. What kind of future do we want? Am I overstepping the boundaries here of the conversation?
I don't think so. And it's not just this country. Isn't it a huge percentage of people all over the globe are voting this year?
I forget how many countries are having. You're right.
Exactly. So
it's hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people who are making decisions.
This is a big choice point. that we're facing this spring.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. So let me go back to the first part of the question. In terms of paradigm shifts, Rick, wouldn't it be really interesting if, based on our recommendations, a lot of people are able to take photographs of the moon during this eclipse, and they have the right technology, they've gone to the websites, they've done their homework, they may have bought that amazing smart telescope in item number 4, and it would be the collective publishing of all those smartphone large views of the moon showing aspects of the dome that could contribute to a grassroots, like the election, determination, which is our real reality.
I know you want me to say yes, and I will say yes, but I think it's only one piece of a much larger, you know, series or sequence of events, but yeah.
Okay, so what's the other sets of items that we should be looking at simultaneously?
Oh, I think everything. I think the awareness.
Ah, you can't look at everything. Come on.
I think the awareness of what Georgia was just talking about and what you set this up, this conversation, I think is everywhere. And no, you can't look at everywhere all at once, but you can look at things and convince yourself that you should be aware of what you're seeing rather than what you're imagining that you can't see. Because how many people in the United States or all over the world are looking at what's going on event by event and seeing something that is very different than what is actually happening because of what they already know to be true?
Or what they think they know to be true.
Well, that's the same thing, yes.
No, it's not.
Exactly.
Science is a process of figuring out which is which. You know,
no, that's true, but these are not scientists. If I know something is true, I don't give a crap about science. I know it's true. Doesn't mean it's true.
Well, it's how do you know? You know, and that to me has been the big question.
Anyhow, but I do think that this is just, I don't want to say just because that minimizes it, but what you're describing here about what we're seeing on the moon is one piece. And there's so many pieces.
Well, wait. It's one hell of a big piece. If it is generally understood and acknowledged in the next, let's say, year, let's say from now till the middle of 2025.
Sure, Richard. But the economy is a big piece. Hold on.
You are looking at this in isolation.
Of deaths that are on this planet right now that have for no reason, that are anomalies, that's a huge piece. What's going on in politics is a huge piece. There's from every which way, there are these huge pieces. And yes, this is a very specific scientific piece. That's another huge piece.
Yeah, but
piece.
It's much more than scientific. It will change everything, starting with the economy. Remember, if there is a physical glass dome, which all these images show us is there, and if you have these super waves, which the video show us is there, then whatever this thing is made of, we need to back engineer this stuff as soon as possible because it will change the economy of the world light years for the better. Light years.
I agree with you, but couldn't that same thing be said for whatever technologies we have in our possession that someone might be reverse engineering, but most of us don't know about?
But we don't have the public forcing function to bring it out from the shadows, from the occult.
I hear you. I'm not sure that we don't, but yeah.
Well, are you seeing anybody doing it?
No, because there's so much resistance from the
government.
That's
why you need something big enough.
You know what, though? Isn't that exactly what just happened with Elon Musk taking, you know, NASA, you know, Beverly Rubik said, apparently Michael's invented a cosmic energy collector. And I'm like, well, what the hell is a cosmic energy collector? Here's Nikola Tesla's 369 unlimited free energy. NASA's already said somehow because of my communication with the Anunnaki, they've gifted me the technology of how to do this. Somehow Elon Musk just took it to the moon. And NASA can tell you it's not passive, it's active. And not only that, they said that the longer something is in its field, the higher photonic light energy from a higher dimensional realm grows exponentially. It's going to be there for the next 10 billion years. I can't even think of what this means, you know?
Yeah, this conversation is outside of my, beyond my pay grade.
Look, let me go back to what I was saying before, which is we've seen all these potential off-ramps, like the 14th Amendment Constitution says, oh, no. An insurrectionist has every right in the world to run as a candidate, which is nuts. It's not the plain reading of the original text, but it looks like there are forces that are demanding that this presidential election be an ultimate choice between all of us and whatever is the backdrop. There are no shortcuts. We are going to have to make the most important choice for ourselves and for the country in our entire lives. In the same way, if enough people, ordinary folks, photograph this eclipse and get indications of what's there that transcends what NASA says, that grassroots, you know, X, Twitter, viral wave of discussion and, you know, incredulity and argument and all that, I somehow feel at a metaphysical level, Georgia, that this is the only way that this incredible nightmare of ignorance imposed upon us can be elegantly cracked, that we can move through it to a new paradigm only if a lot of us, quote, ordinary people, are part of the action.
I think, like Rick was talking about earlier, that this is one avenue where things could break, things could open. I don't think it's the only one, but I think it's a very, very big one. You know, humanity as a soul, as a one life, is going to grow and evolve. It's our nature. We can't not grow and evolve. But our choices are we can do it the long way or the short way. And right now we've got a big choice in front of us as to whether we're going to take the long, slow, painful path or we're going to take the leap and go to the next level as a species.
Does this have to be a conscious choice or can we be maneuvered into having to make the decision, even not realizing, most of us, how important the decision is?
It's a conscious choice at whatever level your consciousness is expressing.
Hmm.
Some people are very emotionally focused. Some people are mentally focused. Some people have a spiritual vision. So this is a choice that, you know, the wonderful thing about the parables that Jesus taught is that they were multi-level, that, you know, the masses took one interpretation and the disciples could see a whole nother layer. So this choice point is multi-layered, and everybody's going to make it where they live with the light that they see by.
So everybody has their own doorways.
Right.
Okay. By the way, Maria is trying to join us, and get this, Kinthea. She says, my internet is dropping in and out. I will try it. She's tried three times now. Keith, can you help her maybe initiate a call from our side and cut through what she's dealing with? Because she's trying to join us. And the reason I want her as part of the party tonight is because these ancient monuments and their relationship to eclipses and energies and ley lines and dragon lines and all that must be an important part of this conversation. So until we can solve Maria's problem, let's see. Somebody have a place they want to go?
Let me see what I can do.
Thank you.
You know what? One thing with the future of America that has not been talked about, and I know this because of my work with Canada, is do you know the Pope just went there to apologize for the crimes against humanity because of all the children's bodies that have been found under the Catholic?
Oh, no. Tell us about it.
The Pope just went to Canada because they found, I think the number is over 12,000 children's bodies buried under those Catholic boarding schools.
These were
the
Catholic boarding schools. Well, they also built tons of them out west.
Well, that's the point. Is those even though those numbers are there in Canada, they were actually based off of American systems, especially in Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota tribes. There was a lot of these boarding schools, and the numbers are probably going to be a lot higher when people in America find out the genocide that happened in this country. And that's not cool. You know, that skeleton has got to be drug out into the light. But this gets into the creation of America.
Wait. Hang on. Why, if the Pope traveled from the Vatican to Canada to do this in person, how come there haven't been any mainstream news stories on it? How can the Pope travel anywhere?
It made it to CNN. It was all over the news. Because, first of all, the Native American Indian lady said, that's a little too little too late. You know, an apology doesn't really cut it now, does it? And they have some of the elders, and it was really weird because one of the chiefs went up and put a Native American Indian headdress right on the Pope's head, which is interesting.
Yeah, of course.
But here's the deal, is that you find out our forefathers, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, met with a Seneca chief. His name was Chief Cornplanter. Matter of fact, Chief Cornplanter taught them this whole idea of we the people and democracy. This isn't how things were done.
Well, wait. Michael, the American experiment, this incredible, fragile democracy is based on, and somebody's got a radio on in the background, I can hear it, is based on the Iroquois Confederacy. The Constitution has huge parts of Native American, you know, democracy lore embedded in it irrevocably. So it's not like this is a new thing to Native Americans. The country that they now live in, kind of like almost semi-strangers sometimes, is based on their own relatives' way of governing from a couple of hundred years ago.
Absolutely. And you'll find the Cornplanter Tract is the first treaty ever signed between George Washington and Chief Cornplanter. And the land around Salamanca, New York, was given to Cornplanter and his heirs. By the way, I am an heir of that lineage. And also around Kinzu Dam. And this is really unfortunate because in the 1960s, our government forced 600 of my people, the Seneca, at gunpoint to move off of that land that was guaranteed theirs by a treaty signed by George Washington and made them move to the New York reservation. Our people call that now the Lake of Betrayal because they just flooded all of our sacred lands. And so what I'm telling you is our people have not forgot. And there's going to be a time in the future, and it's going to be a reckoning, because that land is going to be returned back to the rightful owners, and it's going to be done at the behalf of the Anunnaki saying what's up. Because we're talking about their lost tribe of Israel, the Anunnaki human hybrid bloodline. Of course they're going to be interested in what happens with it.
One would think. Hey, let me give you an update on Maria. She's going to reboot because nothing's working, and Keith is working with her behind the scenes. So we should have her shortly. In the meantime, Michael, describe for me the envisioning of the ceremony with the skull during the eclipse and who will be the participants in this very interesting ceremony.
Well, Bill Hammond and his wife, Kathy, obviously will be there. He's the current guardian of the skull. And then I have my new love interest coming in to spend the week with me, but she actually is a very powerful medicine woman. And her name is McClovia, if you're listening. Love you, baby.
The other side of midnight functions in many different levels, yes.
A bunch of friends and star knowledge people that I've met at Servant Mound and whatnot, they're coming in. And then there's some people that are coming in just for a couple days to, you know. But as far as the actual eclipse day, we're going to be on top of the mound on the Turtle Island mound here. And we are in full totality. And one thing Bill told me I thought was very interesting is in the 2017 full totality eclipse, he was at another location that was in full totality. And when day became night, the skull started to glow blue. He said.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
That might be interesting.
Well, that sounds like what we call Cherenkov radiation, which is any material particle traveling faster than the speed of light in a medium, like water, glass, whatever, will cause a blue wake. So it sounds to me like the skull was resonating to some kind of high energy interaction and glowing the classic Cherenkov radiation blue.
Well, I can send you the video, Bill.
Oh, I'd love to see it, yeah.
And I'm going to be definitely, you know. Hey, by the way, I found out from Bill, you might know this, you might not, but I guess some of the testing that's been done on that skull is the way that the facets are within that quartz crystal, it had to have been made or grown in zero gravity.
Oh, my God, of course, grown in zero G.
Yeah. So
that way there are no tool marks, there's no abrasions, it's seamless, yeah. But, of course, the only people that can do that is a space-faring civilization.
Golden White Eagle, you know, the spiritual leader and chief of the Dakota, he said it's over 200,000 years old, for whatever that's worth.
Well, that kind of matches some of the Sitchin stuff that Keith is always talking to us about.
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, there, Maria and Keith are still working to connect her, so in the meantime... Let me go back to, I want to talk to Georgia, because this question about how is this shaping the environment is so compelling to me. It's like, it's the X factor. It's what nobody counted on. You said there are meditations going on all around the planet. The eclipse is only over the central U.S. So how are the, meditators, let's say in Spain, how are they connecting with the U.S. folks?
Well, the internet is certainly become, you know, the piece de resistance of technology that allows for worldwide meditations to take place. They were taking place before the internet, but it was much, much harder to arrange and set up and, you know, that kind of thing. But now with the technology, everybody all around the globe, no matter where they are, can participate all at the same time in whatever ceremony is taking place. And I know that there are a lot of metaphysical groups that have chosen to do vigils and meditation work on the 8th.
Well, given the physics of this, which is I was able to measure many years ago with Robin standing looking over my shoulder at the screen, the effects on the Akatron of a total lunar eclipse over South Africa. And as the screen, you know, the little lines, the wavy lines from the computer making graph, you know, resonance peaks, as they moved across the right time, I pointed out with my finger, there's the signature of the eclipse. And lo and behold, through the Earth, 8,000 miles, on the other side of the planet, from an occultation which was basically sun, Earth, moon, and then echo, we were able to see here in New Mexico the signature, the hyperdimensional signature of the eclipse. So I don't think you have to be in the path of the eclipse, because what the eclipse does is it rings the bell all over the Earth. So the entrainment would make meditations anywhere at the right time. It's the time that's important, not where you are.
Exactly. You know, all living things not only have this physical dense body that we see, but there's an energy body that underlies it. Again, you think of the acupuncture system or Curlian photography. Well, the planet has a network, an energy network. The ley lines are part of that grid, and it's instantaneous around the planet. This is this vital body that supports physicality. Physicality is like the crust on the real body, which is an energy body.
Which is multidimensional. Did I say that before? Okay, Maria's still working. I want her to come on because I wanted to talk about how the planet rings, literally. Do you remember, Rick, when we went to the moon with Apollo for the first time and they were dropping rocket parts to create seismic activity that the seismometers could measure. And they found this bizarre echo from I think it was the Apollo 12 upper stage, because they had a seismometer on 11, which didn't work very long, and then it quit. They had one work really well on 12, and it worked for years. And it was the one on 12 that reported that when the S4B upper stage crashed on the moon, deliberately designed to excite seismic activity so the seismometers could have something to look at, the moon rang like a bell for over an hour. Over an hour.
I kind of remember that.
Well, everybody's got it wrong because they think the moon is hollow, and that's what the
right.
S4B... No, it's not. It's all
right.
The glass in the domes suspended in the crust of the moon that when you shatter something in their midst, energy, like an energy release, like a bomb, which is what an impacting rocket is, that shockwave will transmit through the dome and create losslessly the same seismic signatures that NASA saw, but they attributed to lack of water in the rocks and other stupid geophysical stuff, because, of course, publicly, they don't know anything about the dome. Privately, of course, I think they know everything about it, and that's another conversation. Michael, what kind of, and we've got basically a minute left here in this segment, what kind of ceremony are you going to be doing during the eclipse in Ohio directly in that 4 minutes?
Music, mainly, using Cosmic Harmonious Frequencies, 432 singing bowls. I might even bring my acoustic guitar. I don't know. It's still
is anybody going to be trying to commune through the skull to whoever is waiting in the hyperdimensional phone booth to talk to you?
Well, we all are. And I'm totally expecting, you know, I've got film of these chariots of fire coming out of Lake Erie. And it's constant. It's still ongoing to this day. So I don't know why they wouldn't show up. So I'm fully expecting a light show. And but still, I'm one of the only people that he actually lets touch the skull. You're not allowed to touch it. It's a priceless artifact. He was offered $100 million for it, by the way, and he turned
what?
It down. Yeah.
Who offered
Bill
him
Hammond.
That? No, who offered it?
I don't know.
Well,
he just
that's very important
that.
Because whoever did that knows the power of the quartz and the physics, obviously.
Yeah.
So knowing
yeah.
who that is kind of important.
I could find out.
Yeah, please do.
I'll be with him. But the point is, I don't know. He might let me touch it sometimes.
Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour. Everyone hold it right there. My guests this morning are Rick Levine, Georgia Lambert, and Michael Hill, and Maria Wheatley is desperately from England trying to join us. Her internet is unhappy this morning. So everybody think cool, quiet thoughts about her internet so she can join the last half hour. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Our program on the coming eclipse will return.
TheOtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The Other Side of Midnight.com.
Here's an oldie but a goodie. Billy Bright. A song he wrote for The Other Side of Midnight. A little bass added by a guy named Ryan Gunster. Enjoy.
Time for you to wander through the mansions in your mind. Nothing to lose, there's everything to find. Other side.
And welcome back, everyone. Last half hour to go here on this Saturday night, Sunday morning. 1 week and a few hours ahead of the probably the most important eclipse of our lifetimes. Because if even only a tenth of the things we're talking about are real, it's one you don't want to miss. If it's, you know, like here in New Mexico, it's 75% in Albuquerque. I told a friend of mine this afternoon, I said, look, if you really want to see it, drive east a couple of hundred miles, because there's a difference between totality and partial that is indescribable. Okay, back to our guests. We still don't have Maria with us, unfortunately. Sometimes the internet conspires so that you can't really do what you want to do. I want to go to you, Georgia, and Rick. Kinthea, by all means, if you want to join in, you know, don't be a stranger. It's your show, too. I want to ask both of you, Georgia and Rick, have you noticed anything weird happening with people who seem to think that time is changing? Let me give you a very specific example. A couple weeks ago, it was March 3rd of 2024, which is exactly 5 years to the night since Robin died. And every time I think of that, I somehow recoil, because to me, it does not seem like 5 years, half a decade. And everyone I've talked to, including both of you guys, you've had the same reaction. So here's my question. Is it possible, because of changes in the background physics, the 26,000-year precessional cycle and the alignments that come with eclipses, is it possible that we are dealing with two different time standards, which are, because of the change of physics, are becoming more and more out of synchronization, so that the celestial mechanic, calendrical, mathematical recounting of time, which is the basis of the calendar, of course, is different, has been disconnected somehow from our conscious perception of time, and the eclipse will only accelerate this bifurcation to where time itself will have a different set of meanings in addition to looking at a clock and a calendar. Okay, 2 one-word answers. You've
yep.
got you've got 20 minutes to amplify.
Well, you know, it's said that our outer environment is a reflection of our inner environment. The example I always use is if you hang a light bulb from the ceiling and turn it on, that light is going to go everywhere in the room. It's going to go on the walls and the floor and the ceiling. But if you put one of those little tin lanterns over the light bulb that has like stars and moons and cutouts, then what you see on the walls and the ceiling are little stars and moons and cutouts. So one of the basic tenets of metaphysical work is that as you become more conscious, time speeds up. It's like an ice skater pulling your arms in, you spin faster. And so as the consciousness of humanity begins to separate itself from the sheep and the goats, those that want to leap ahead and those that want to stay asleep, the owls and the roosters, however you want to think about it, you're going to have these differences in the perception of time.
I also like to add something.
Cynthia?
Yes.
Oh, good.
I also would like to add something here.
Go for it.
And that is, so as I'm perceiving it with this eclipse coming up, I do really feel in my bones there's some huge shift in consciousness happening. And I would say that we are moving more towards a sense of being multidimensional, more dreamlike, that realities are going to be perceived very differently by different individuals. So we won't all be perceiving reality, even right now.
Right now it's going on.
I know, but it's going to be even more so. And just as in the dream world, time is, it's very fluid. It stretches and shrinks and stretches and shrinks. I sense that it's going to be even more accelerated in our waking state, that there's more of this dream awareness, this lucidity of other realms of consciousness coming forward into our daily consciousness.
Well, this goes back to Michael's experiment with the crystal skull, because I really believe, based on data, on real evidence, that in that moment, in that 4 minutes, if you set it up right, Michael, you could get in contact with anybody or a succession of anybody's who might have some very important things to say. So I would presume you're recording and television and microphones and all that.
Yes, it's all being filmed, but I'm open for suggestions. This is all kind of, I think that skull has a mind of its own. It kind of just, it brings what it wants to happen together, I've noticed. And
I'm not the guy to talk to about occult transmissions through skulls to hyperdimensions, but Cynthia is, and Georgia is, and Rick are, so what would you suggest to Michael that they ask in terms of mega questions?
Well, you know, Rick made a comment in the chat earlier about the corpus callosum, which is the bridge between the major hemispheres of the brain. It's a bridge that allows for connection and integration. And it seems to me, with my limited knowledge in this area, that the skull is like one of those bridges. And so what you connect on both sides is really important, and it is shaped by intent. Mm-hmm. So you have to have your intent very, very clear and hold it steady and see what happens.
And I would say that that's the first part of the equation, and I know Georgia will agree with what I'm going to say, and that is once you create that intent, the more you hold on to it, the less it can happen. In other words, there has to be that release point. This is like Zen in the Art of Archery. You're never going to hit the target unless you release the arrow. And
right,
we know that psychic transmissions occur not while you're thinking of it. It's the moment your mind relaxes and you make your mind clear that it happens. And so I think it's playing that pulse of energy of incredible focus. And this is one of the advantages that music has in ritual like this, because it puts our mind into a more receptive state where we're not trying to get the answer. We're just being open to it if it happens.
Yes.
I totally agree with what you're saying, Rick. And Lori Williams, who's a great teacher of remote viewing, she gives exercises to put the conscious mind entertained with something else so that you can dial in and focus and bring in information without the conscious mind interfering. And this letting go of the arrow, it's absolutely necessary.
It's why we blow the candle out on our birthdays after we make the wish. It's a wish. No, it's basically
a witchy thing.
I thought
it was so
thing.
We didn't get icing in the damn wax.
Yeah, well.
You mean wax in the icing?
Both, yes, both.
Well, you know, the story of the Grail Knight was not to come up with answers, but to ask the right questions.
That's right. What
because
else?
Because when, exactly, when you formulate the right question, you automatically establish a relationship, the answer. And mm-hmm. so you've got to have the intent to create the landing pad, but then you've got to open the landing pad.
See, one of the mm-hmm. things that I discovered measuring these eclipses with the Accutron is the effects. You don't have to be in totality. You can be anywhere where the moon and the sun are overlapping. The sun.
Richard,
has,
what's an Accutron? Could you explain that to those of us who don't know?
An Accutron is a 1965 Bulova watch, which was brought out by Bulova as the first advance in timekeeping in 300 years. And instead of having a balance wheel or a wind-up spring, it had a tuning fork and a little battery and an electronic circuit that made the watch tuning fork vibrate back and forth inside the thing on your wrist at 360 cycles per second. And what the alignment between the sun and the moon does, it changes the inertia of the tuning fork. It should not. It cannot. All mainstream science says Hoagland is lying. It never can do that. And Hoagland says, just do it yourself. Watch the results. Somehow the physical alignment of Earth and Moon changes, among other things, the inertia of a vibrating system. So I monitor with the changes of Accutron vibration what the background physics is and what it might be conducive to doing in other realms, such as someone sitting, holding the skull, looking into it, opening their mind to either a download of interesting information, that's an understatement, guys, or a framing of questions that may trigger a download of interesting information. What kind of procedures, Michael, are you bringing to bear? Because you don't have just 4 minutes. You've got hours to do this.
I'm going to be, this time around, I'm going to be with it for 3 days under the same.
Well, then you'll be able to do a before and after.
Yeah.
We call that in science a controlled experiment. But no, you have a much bigger window than 4 minutes. That's only the visual high point. You've got hours from first contact to fourth contact. You've got 2, maybe 3 hours of time while the moon is in alignment with the sun. Then you have proximity. Then you have further proximity. In other words, you've got an incredible window to find out something from someone who knows more than we do.
Well, I'm going to be asking for a download, and I can tell you, I don't really get communicated to by inanimate, I can't even talk, objects. But when I first sat down in front of that skull,
Wait. You mean consciousness without a body?
Yes. I heard plain as day in my head, touch your forehead to mine. And I had to look at Bill and go, Bill, I don't, this thing's talking to me.
The third eye? Said, the pineal gland?
Yeah. And wow. I said, it just told me to touch my forehead, its forehead. And he said, yes, I know, and you have permission, but I want you to know that's a very advanced initiation. So I did.
So it started the conversation at a mid-level. with you.
Yeah, it's like, and I, you know, because some things have happened with the skull as well, because all this was filmed for a new TV series coming out called Quest of the Crystal Skull, and the head producer contacted me because they had filmed a lady in New York. Her name was Emily Ra, and they asked her after the session with the skull, did it give you any message to give to mankind? And she said, yes, it did. It showed me a seven-pointed star and the words Morning Star. Well, this flipped the producer out because he knows that's my message. You know, when you put a 432 base frequency four octaves below, which is 27 hertz, put it through a new, like, science cymatic device that makes frequency visible, it creates a perfect seven-pointed star. Seven-pointed star is forever intertwined into cosmic harmonious frequencies. There are two ways of expressing the exact same star knowledge. And Morning Star is a whole nother subject, but that deals with the revealing of lost hidden history for this planet.
Oh, my. Really? What an intriguing idea.
Wait. I got to add here, because mathematically, harmoniously, the five-pointed star materializes in nature very easily. The seven-pointed star, Johannes Kepler wrote, God doesn't use sevens. They're too complicated. And there's something about that seven-pointed star astrologically that's associated with all kinds of alien interactions, interventions, observations, and so on. It's disincarnate consciousness.
Well, guys, you know why, right? Seven symmetry spins of a tetrahedron. That's why we have 7 days in the week, by the way.
All right, well, I'll tell you, one night, this voice in my head says, you got to get up and divide a circle by seven. And I was like, honey, I got to get up and do some math. And she's like, okay, you freak. Go ahead.
Okay, let me do an update on Maria. We're having no joy. Keith, my resident genius guru on the internet, cannot get her. So obviously somebody did not want her at a cosmic level to be part of this conversation. What we're going to do is we're going to reconvene this faculty after the eclipse. We'll decide among us when. And one of the things we're going to ask Michael to do is to report exactly what happened with whom, when, what. And what I need to know from you is, how, Georgia, can you prepare Michael to get the most bang out of his crystal skull, you know, buck, in terms of what to ask, how to frame it, and how to feel in framing it?
Well, I couldn't answer that in 20 easy words.
We don't.
Not for that. I'd have to sit with Michael and find out, you know, what his inner practices are and what his methodology is.
You can do it offline, you know. You know each other's phone numbers and emails and all that. I'm just, for the audience, give an overview that this is a really important opportunity that should not be wasted.
Absolutely.
Let me tell you, I'm a deep meditator, and the reason I was brought into the remote viewers is I have a very, like, natural ability to do so. If that helps at all.
What occurred to me when you were talking about the seven-pointed star, you know, a traditional temple floor starts with four directions. This is true whether we're talking about a Native American, a Tibetan, a Masonic, a Rosicrucian temple. You've got north, south, east, and west, four directions.
Well, even in the Egyptians, they had the stretching of the cord to find the coordinates.
Right. So you start with the four directions, north, south, east, and west. Then you add center, which is
point of origin,
the point where you can master the four elements. That makes the five, or the five-pointed star, which is the symbol of the perfected persona. Then you add two more to make it seven, which is the two directions you add are up and down.
Oh, my gosh.
And the number... The next level is a nine-pointed star, and the two directions are in and out.
Interesting.
In and out of this dimension.
Would that be like a whole other phase of evolution in the future?
Yeah, nine is considered the number of the initiate. So, you know, work on the path has to do with mastering the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water, or north, south, east, and west, from the center point. But growth doesn't stop there. There's up and down in frequency. Remember, as above, so below implies a middle. And that middle is you, the conscious soul that's evolving.
And
then,
actually, in the truth of the matter, the as above and so below are the one, and the middle is actually where the perception is. But it's not the that the above and below are reflections of one another. It's the above and below are one, and we're kind of riding on some sort of interference pattern that sees the two. That's,
exactly.
Think, yeah.
Well,
then the point of mastery is in and out, meaning in and out of what is called the three lower worlds of human experience.
These are all very Native American First Nation understandings, by the way. The original Morning Star is the four directions. It's the medicine wheel. It's the compass, four-pointed star. But then moving into the seven, which they've shown me a brand new seed of life, by the way, and it's seven petals. But it's interesting because the seven petaled version has never been seen before. It's all feminine, by the way. It's all Vesca Pisces or Piscis, whatever, however you pronounce it. But the seven petaled star is, see, what happened is when they told me to divide a circle by seven, you get 51.428, which is very interesting because, again, that's the ley line. I mean, the latitude line of planet Earth, 51.428 precisely is what runs through Avebury and through Stonehenge and through Canada's Stonehenge. And it's almost like it's pinpointing, because of its connection to a seven-pointed star, which would be 432 base frequencies, and that's the frequencies of, you know, Richard, you're going to be really amazed by this, because we talked about the work we did with trying to communicate with this intelligence, and we got back this formula, equation, that I just found out is absolutely accurate, and that is, you know, 432 times 432 is C. So 432 based frequencies are the only frequencies that fit into E equals MC squared that are truly harmonics of light. But then 432 times the golden ratio squared divided by 360 equals the mathematical constant of pi. That all came through, and it's all verified now through AI. I said, check all of this out, and, you know,
what you're talking about is an alternative unified field theory. That things are connected, but you have to follow the numbers to see how they're connected.
Exactly. Yeah. So for the first time ever, you know, this could be bigger than E equals MC squared for this world, because it's both the particle and the wave component, because E equals MC squared is only the particle part of the equation. M equals mass. Where's the wave? Well, it's hidden because 432 squared is C.
So what kinds of concepts or questions in this, and you'll have much more on the trailing side of the eclipse? Because remember Maria, who we're still trying to get hold of, and it's not working, so we'll have to have her in a future show. She found from her measurements at these ancient sites in Europe that the lag effect of eclipses is greater on the downside, in other words, after the physical event, than it is before. So you should have, if you're spending days with the skull, the most interesting conversation may be after the eclipse is over.
Right on.
And I would say that that's true only if it's set up going into it, that the after is the after effects, where that is where that's where the resonance occurs. But it has to be established as, you know, as prior. By the way, one other thing about the division by seven, you said that the division by seven produces 51 into 360 produces 51.428. One of the important things is that it's not 51.428. It's actually rounded up to 51.429 because it's 51.428571 to a, it's one of these, it's a decimal that never resolves.
Yeah, it's called
and that's
irrational
why sevens
number.
Are so complicated manifesting in three-dimensional world, because they, there is no ratio, it can't be expressed as a ratio.
So, so if the modalities for talking through the skull to whoever wants to talk to you are set up right, Rick, what do you mean by if they're set up correctly? Describe that.
Well, in other words, the time in which, let's say, any astrological phenomena, like a new moon, people who practice magic say that the real work of a new moon should be done not at the moment of the new moon, but in the hours and days afterwards, where it's grabbing into reality and the resonance is manifesting. Now, I agree with that, but it's prior to the new moon at the ending of the previous cycle when we set up the energy that then becomes released that allows the manifestation to occur. So I think that we don't see the results until after, but it's going into the event, prior to the event, where we actually need to be paying attention and focusing our awareness.
By the way, I made a mistake earlier, and Georgia nicely corrected me. The forehead is the pituitary. It's the top of the head, which is the pineal. Sorry.
Now that we're on the eve of Easter, let me just throw in the reason why we celebrate the crucifixion with bunnies and eggs. It comes from the Celtic goddess Eostre, a fertility goddess whose symbols were the rabbit and the egg. So happy Easter, everybody.
I just heard a joke and I thought, we're all adults here. Do you know why the Easter bunny hides his eggs?
No.
He doesn't want anyone to know he's been screwing chickens.
God. Yes. If I had a big gong, I would use it. So, okay.
Said I was funny.
We've got about
And of course,
we have about
the fact
two.
Is,
go ahead.
The fact is that Easter is always set astrologically because it doesn't fit into the solar calendar, because the Hebrews used the lunar calendar. And of course, the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. So that was on Passover, which was based upon a lunar calendar. But there was a big controversy as to setting Easter around the time of Johannes Kepler, who basically said, this is a religious issue, not a scientific issue. I pass. But Easter is always on the first Sunday after the first full moon, after the sun moves into Aries, meaning the vernal equinox.
And on that note, guys, we've run out of runway. So we're going to have you all back to talk about what happened after the eclipse. Particularly, I'm really fascinated, Michael, to find out what it is that you're going to be told, because I have a feeling, if Georgia and Rick are right, that this eclipse could be kind of unlike any other. You've got the proper transponder in the skull to connect with something or someone, and who knows what answers you might receive. Thank you, everyone. My guest this morning is Georgia Lambert and Rick Levine, Michael Hill. We're sorry that Maria couldn't join us. Obviously, she will be joining us on the next show on this subject. Tomorrow night, I'm going to be talking at great length with Steve Bassett. We're going to try to figure out what's going on with the Pentagon. How come they can't get their act straight? Do they really think that this ridiculous report is going to hold water? Tune in tomorrow night and find out. So until then, remember, third star on the left, straight until morning. Good night, everyone, and get ready for the eclipse.